Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome once again to the KGOU Readers Club. I'm your host, Logan Layden, and today I'm joined by David Barron. He's the author of the new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. David, thanks for joining me for the hour. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Logan. I'm pleased to be here.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're going to get into the book itself, but there's so much I want to talk to you about outside of that. This is a pretty exciting time here in Oklahoma. We've got a total eclipse that's going to be coming over the southeast part of our state very soon on April 8th. And it's something people down in that area are preparing for. Emergency managers are creating plans to deal with the influx of people. So I want to talk about the book, but I also want to talk about eclipses also in general. But first, let's learn a little bit more about you. You're no stranger to public radio, by the way.
No, I spent most of my career in public radio. I started, back in the 1980s. I worked for WBUR in Boston as a science correspondent. In the 90s, I went and worked as a science correspondent for NPR. And then starting in 2004, I was a science editor behind the scenes for the public radio program, The World. I loved working in public radio. I remain a big fan of public radio, but I've moved on to writing books.
Yes, indeed. Well, welcome back to public
Thank
radio.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your sort of motivations for writing this book, American Eclipse. You've been, from what I understand, just fascinated with eclipses for a long time. Can you just talk to us a little bit about where that sort of inspiration comes from, why you like this so much, why you wrote a book about it?
Sure. Well, actually, you set it up perfectly. It actually stems from my days working for NPR. So back in 1994, when I was a science correspondent for NPR, there was a solar eclipse, a partial solar eclipse, that was going to cross the country, and I did a story about it for Morning Edition. And in the course of my reporting, I interviewed an astronomer named Jay Pasikoff, who worked at Williams College in Massachusetts. He was a solar astronomer. He was passionate about eclipses, and he explained what was going to happen with this partial eclipse and how to view it. But he emphasized that as interesting as a partial solar eclipse, a much rarer total solar eclipse is completely different. And a total solar eclipse, he described as the most awe-inspiring sight in all of nature. And at the end of that interview, Jay Pasikoff turned to me and said something I'll never forget. He said, before you die, you owe it to yourself to experience a total solar eclipse. And I'm not used to, a scientist I'm interviewing talking to me so intimately and so directly, but he said it with such passion and sincerity that I took him seriously. And so 4 years later, I went to see my first total eclipse. It was in Aruba in February of 1998, I thought. And I went there specifically to see the eclipse, to see what Jay Pasikoff was talking about. It was unbelievable. It just, I felt for 3 minutes like I had left Earth and I was looking at an alien sky. I just felt viscerally connected to the universe. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say it because I'm not a religious person. It was a spiritual experience for me. And so I became an eclipse chaser. I've now seen 8 total solar eclipses on 5 continents. But as a science writer on that beach in Aruba in 1998, I had the idea I wanted to write a book to bring to the broader public the excitement of a total eclipse. And it became a long-term project because that was 1998. The next total eclipse to cross the United States would not be till 2017. So my book actually was first published in hardcover in 2017. It's now just been re-released in paperback for the total eclipse of 2024.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. A couple of times in my own life, I've seen partial eclipses, even just a few months ago. We had one here
in October, correct?
Yeah, in Oklahoma, and it was really neat to get the glasses, look up at the sun, and see it, blocked out, and things get dark. Kind of a cool thing. I've seen it a couple of times, but being in the totality is a totally different thing. Can you describe? Because you can even, from what I understand, you can during those couple of minutes, you can even take the glasses off and look
precisely
right at it. What do you see whenever you do? Because I'm wondering, it's right down the road. if exactly. this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, is it worth driving down there and
absolutely.
Looking at it? Yeah,
absolutely. So back in, I'll answer your questions in a minute, but back in 2017, I gave a TED talk about where I was encouraging people to go see the total eclipse. And I was explaining how a total eclipse is something you want to see at least once in your lifetime. And I remember I got, after the total eclipse in 2017, there were a bunch of people who sent me very flattering emails that they had seen my TED talk online, and that's what inspired them to go see the eclipse. And I remember one in particular, some folks who lived in Philadelphia, who apparently they saw my TED talk a day or two beforehand, and they decided they would just hit the road at midnight and drive to Tennessee because they had to go there to see the total eclipse. And they just had a crazy night sleeping in the car when they got there. They got stuck in the worst traffic ever coming home, but it was so totally worth it, they said. They were so glad that I encouraged them to go. So to answer your question, Oklahoma City will see a 94% partial eclipse. That's pretty neat. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's almost as good as a total eclipse, not a millionth as good. Because until it's total, as you said, all you're going to see is a crescent sun through really dark eclipse glasses. It's interesting, but the day is still going to remain daylight. I mean, the light may look a little odd, but it's not going to get dark. It's only when you're in that path that all of a sudden the lights go out and you're plunged into twilight. It's not dark as midnight, but it's sort of like 40 minutes after sunset. And it, so much about it is alien. The colors of the sky are different. It's twilight overhead, sort of a purple gray, while you're surrounded by a 360-degree sunset. It's orange on the horizon all around you. And because you can take off the eclipse glasses, this is the only time it's safe to look at the sun with the naked eye, you are looking with your own eyes at the sun. And although the surface is covered, what you're seeing is the sun's outer atmosphere called the solar corona. And it's the most dazzling sight in the heavens. It looks like a wreath or a crown that's made out of tinsel. It's like made out of or silk. You see these strands to it. And it just shimmers out in space. And also, if the skies are clear, you'll see the planets too. So you are literally in the daytime looking at the middle of our solar system. You're seeing the sun and the planets together. And that's one of the things that really struck me when I first saw my first total eclipse was, oh my gosh, this is our solar system. It looks like exactly like in a high school textbook. There's the sun. There are the planets. The planets orbit the sun. I am looking at the sun 93 million miles away. I just had a sense of the enormous scale of the universe. It made me feel both tiny and insignificant, and also it's sort of emboldened. It's sort of empowering because I realized I am part of this universe. And again, this is where it becomes almost spiritual. It really struck home in the most gut level way that I am floating in space. I am on a piece of rock floating around the sun. And isn't this marvelous? And it was magical. And it lasted for 3 minutes. And then it was over. And suddenly I was back on Earth. And I got hooked. And now I go have this experience whenever I can. So to put a fine point on this, if you are anywhere near the path of totality, you should make it a priority to get into the path of totality, because in some ways, the biggest tragedy of all is to see a 99% partial eclipse, because you could have gone 20 or 30 miles and you would have seen the full thing.
Yeah. And there's lots of people that are going to be doing just that here in Oklahoma. I was down in far southeast Oklahoma this past weekend in Broken Bow, which is going to be in the totality. It's kind of a tourist area anyway that's growing. But you know, talking to some of the business owners, I mean, they're expecting like hundreds of thousands of people. Like the state is coming out to put porta potties along the highway for the influx of people that are coming down there to see this extremely rare event. Right at any point in the globe, I think you say it in the book, it's about once every 400 years or so you can expect to see such a thing. So in many ways, this
correctly.
Is
correct.
unless you're able to fly to Aruba or chase them around the globe, it can be a once in a lifetime opportunity. Right?
Absolutely. Particularly if it comes to you. The next one in the contiguous United States won't be for another 20 years. Where I live in Colorado, in Boulder, there won't be one going over my house until 2772, more than 700 years from now. So to have one come near you is a gift that you don't want to ignore.
So, yeah, maybe you go a little bit out of your way to get into the totality.
Oh, yeah. I completely get it. People have busy lives, you know, mortgages to pay, kids in school. This is such a rare and dazzling experience. It's worth having a crazy day, taking the kids out of school, just making it a priority, just a day to appreciate being alive on the planet Earth.
Well, you've convinced me.
Good.
The book is American Eclipse. The author is David Barron. I'm Logan Layden. You're listening to the KGOU Readers Club as we talk about the book. We're back with the KGOU Readers Club. I'm your host, Logan Layden. The book is American Eclipse, and the author is David Barron, who joins me for the rest of the hour. As we get into the book itself now, give us sort of a general synopsis, basically. You pick this book up, what are you going to be reading?
Sure. So the book is a true story of a total solar eclipse that crossed America's Wild West in 1878. So a total eclipse is visible only along a relatively narrow path called the Path of Totality. This year, that path goes from Texas to Maine and, as you said, across the southeastern corner of Oklahoma. In 1878, the Path of Totality went from Montana territory down to Texas. And this was a time when total eclipses were keenly important for science. Astronomers were just starting to answer some basic questions about the sun and the solar system. I mean, what is the sun made of? What fuels its fires? And there were certain questions that could be addressed only during a total solar eclipse, which is something that happens about once every year and a half on a very small part of the planet. But it was so important that astronomers would put together these elaborate expeditions to Africa or Asia or the Arctic to sit in the Path of Totality for an event that was going to last 3 minutes. And then when the sun was eclipsed, they would frantically do their observations. And the reason it was so important, or the reason it helped, was when the moon completely blocks the surface of the sun, that enables you to look at what's around the sun, to look at the sun's outer atmosphere, the corona, to see what the inner parts of the solar system look like. Are there any planets in there closer than Mercury? So in 1878, dozens of the era's great scientists went out to the Wild West. This included some well-known names. The best known was Thomas Edison, who had just become a global celebrity because of his invention of the phonograph. He went to Wyoming to witness the eclipse, to actually do his own experiment. There was an all-female expedition from Vassar College that went to Denver to show that women could be scientists as well. There were a number of these just wonderful tales, and it says so much about America at that time. We were still a young nation. We had just turned 100 2 years before. We were becoming economically powerful, but Europe looked down their noses at us when it came to intellectual pursuits, when it came to art and music and literature and science. The Europeans didn't really think we were competitive. But here was a big deal, a scientific event happening in our own backyard. This became America's chance to show what it could do in science. And so it was an important event in helping America become the global superpower in science that it would become in the 20th century.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And at that time, there's this competition that's happening basically between the United States and Europe, at least in the early part of the book. You talk about that quite a bit. Trying to discover planets, not planets as we think of them nowadays, asteroids, but this actual sort of race going on where America's trying to prove its scientific worth, I guess.
Right. Yeah. You bring up, so Asteroids, which of course are small bodies that orbit the sun, mostly between Mars and Jupiter, back in the 19th century, not very many asteroids had been found, and they were considered planets. They were tiny, but they were given names, just like the major planets, and finding them was a big deal. And as you said, there was this race to see which country would lead the world in the finding of these small planets. And there was so a competition between countries and then a competition between people. And one of the scientists I focus on was a planet hunter. He found asteroids from the University of Michigan named James Craig Watson. And he came out to the Wild West in 1878, determined to find a planet closer to the sun than Mercury. In fact, it wasn't just there wasn't just a guess that it might be there. There was a well, quite a strong feeling by astronomers that there had to be a planet closer to the sun than Mercury, because Mercury's orbit acted as if there was a planet there. And the planet was given a name. It was called Vulcan. And James Craig Watson, the planet hunter from the University of Michigan, was determined in 1878 to be the man who would finally find this hypothetical planet, Vulcan.
And he sort of did. Well, yeah. You focus on three different scientists with somewhat different motivations for wanting to get out west and be in the totality. And just to make it clear to folks, that's Thomas Edison, who everybody knows, Watson, who you mentioned as well, and then also Mariah Mitchell.
Correct.
Which,
She was the one from Vassar.
that's one of the things I appreciated about the book was being introduced to this historical character who I was not aware of previously, a woman who was trying to do these things, be a scientist at a time when that was not accepted
Correct.
very well. So she was, yeah.
I mean, and that probably won't surprise anyone that it was hard to be a female scientist in the 19th century. What might surprise folks is that even going to college for a woman was still considered somewhat controversial. So this was a time when women's colleges were just coming to be, that included Vassar, which was founded in the 1860s. Mariah Mitchell taught astronomy there. And in the 1870s, there was this scare that perhaps women going to college was a dreadful idea, because according to a Boston doctor who wrote a best-selling book in 1873, higher education could actually ruin a girl's physical health. And the argument went like this, that if a young woman used her brain too much, that would sap energy from other parts of her maturing body, including her reproductive organs, and would turn her into a sterile masculine invalid. And this book caused a panic. I mean, there really was this sense that higher education for women was this risky social experiment that could just backfire. Well, with this as a backdrop, Mariah Mitchell, who taught astronomy to women at Vassar, in 1878, considering this book that was written to be ridiculous, she wanted to show to the American public that it was ridiculous. And so at a time when groups of men were putting together these eclipse expeditions to the Wild West, with the help of the federal government, which was providing logistical support and money, Mariah Mitchell, on her own, put together an all-female expedition to Denver, which was a scientific expedition like the ones assembled by the men, but there was a whole other level of meaning, which was it was kind of political theater to show to the American public that women could be smart and educated and healthy and feminine too. There's just a great photograph that I have in my book of the Vassar College eclipse party in Denver. And it shows these women in Victorian dresses sitting very daintily on chairs next to their telescopes on the plains of Colorado. And it just that says so much about what Mariah Mitchell was trying to prove about how women could be women and could be strong enough to go on their own to Colorado, and they could be scientists.
Well, and she would use sort of she had to make these arguments, and she would use sort of the times in them as far as one of the things that I remember about as she's trying to convince people that women are the perfect people to be taking these measurements. Think of needlework, the precision of it, the meticulousness of it, the focus that it takes. Some of the things that ladies are doing lend themselves to this sort of work, right?
Exactly. I mean, it would have been, I think, too strong a statement to say that women are the same as men, that women are equal to men. And so her argument was women are different. But those differences exactly show how women could be really important to science. Because in astronomy, it's all about precision, about finding the exact location of what it is you're seeing in the sky, being able to accurately represent, you know, the color of a star. And so she was saying, you know, the way women can match fabrics and or yarns, the colors, they're so good at that, that that's something that could be useful for women to be in science too. Yeah, Mariah Mitchell was very vocal about trying to get more women into science. And she was an inspiration for generations of women. She taught the next generation of female scientists. Some of them then went on to teach the next. And for a long time, well into the 20th century, people did know her name and were inspired by her.
So Mariah Mitchell, we've talked a little bit about Watson. He's looking for planets, particularly right. Vulcan. What are Edison's motivations here? He's trying to test equipment, things he's invented. Talk a little bit about his role in this and what his goals were in trying to get out that to that totality.
Well, I had so much fun getting to know Thomas Edison because this is not the Thomas Edison most of us think of. I mean, I think probably the view most of us have is this elderly man who's already an icon of America. But this was a young Thomas Edison. He was 31 years old. He was really still just a kid. He, at that stage of his career, he wanted to be more than an inventor. He wanted to be a scientist. He wanted to be taken seriously by these professors of physics and chemistry and astronomy. And he was friendly with a number of them. And he had the idea that at the 1878 eclipse, he would do his own astronomical experiment. So he came up with a new device that was called the tezimeter. It was an extremely sensitive heat detector that he claimed could measure changes in temperature as small as 1/1,000,000th of a degree Fahrenheit. Today we would call it an infrared detector. It basically could detect heat rays coming off of things. And his idea was during the total eclipse, which was only going to last less than 3 minutes, he would point it at the solar corona. Again, we know today that the solar corona, this beautiful aura that appears around the sun during a total eclipse, today we know it's the sun's outer atmosphere. They didn't know what it was back then. They didn't know if it was part of the sun or it was a period when they thought it might be the atmosphere of the moon backlit by the sun, or maybe it was just kind of a mirage, something created in our own atmosphere by the sunlight during an eclipse. But anyway, whatever it was, astronomers were trying to get as much information about it as they could. And with the tezimeter, Edison figured he could point it at that strange halo and see if the corona gave off heat as well as light. And that was an important thing to find out at the time. So that's what motivated him to go out west. And he, being already a celebrity for his invention of the phonograph, the reporters were following him everywhere. In fact, there was a reporter from the New York Herald who went with him, who was kind of the eclipse correspondent with Edison.
And of course, you know, back then in the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, it's not as easy as hopping in your car and driving a couple hours to look at the eclipse. Obviously, these were long expeditions, and there were trials along the way. For some of them, if you could speak to that a little bit as far as what they encountered in their effort as they scrambled to get into the totality.
Right. Well, I mean, this, you know, this was the Wild West, which was both an exciting place and it could be a dangerous place. I mean, there were train robberies there right around this time. There was a lot of fighting between the pioneers and Native Americans. You know, it was, you were taking on some risk when you were going out west. There were railroad accidents. But there were also problems with luggage, and that ended up being an issue that Mariah Mitchell had to deal with. You know, she brought along her telescopes, and she packed them in a couple of, she took them apart, packed them in a couple of bags. Unfortunately, one of the bags didn't make it all the way to Denver, and she spent a frantic few days trying to track down what had happened to some of her telescope parts. But the train that Edison was on going to Wyoming not long before had been held up by train robbers. While he was in Rawlins, Wyoming, Edison met with one of the train robbers who was at the local jail. He really kind of enjoyed being in the Wild West and the excitement of it all. He, in the middle of the night, a gunslinger ended up coming to his door who wanted to meet the famous Edison, and Edison was terrified. But it made for a good story.
Well, you know, we talk about in the book the these particular scientists, the situation with the country at the time, the importance of the eclipse. But in true public radio fashion, you draw people in at the beginning of the book with a really interesting story that sort of captures folks' attention. This is all also happening at a time when people are trying to predict the end of the world, and it's coming soon. The Seventh-day Adventists, right? And this guy down in Texas who, when the eclipse happened, did a little murder-suicide type of thing. Not right. Everybody, it's not like it is in today times where everybody knows this is happening and it's in the news. For a lot of people, this wasn't something that was expected. And for some, it was a sort of a sign that the end of the world is coming. Can you tell us a little bit about that story from early in the book?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so it actually struck me when I was doing research for the book that most people did know it was coming. I was surprised at the extent to which, you know, the astronomers knew how to predict the eclipse well in advance. They mapped the path of totality. The newspapers were all over it. There were tourists coming into Denver. In a lot of ways, it was the same kind of experience we're having today. However, there were some people who didn't realize it was coming, and particularly in one part of Texas south of Fort Worth, in Johnson County, Texas. I found a lot of reports of, and just generally that part of Texas, folks who didn't know it was coming. And you can imagine they're out in their farm fields on a hot July day, and all of a sudden it goes dark. And they look up in the sky, and it's not like a cloud's come over, but in fact, the sun is gone. And where the sun should be, there's this beautiful heavenly crown. And it's the devout part of Texas, and people, where there had been predictions of Christ returning for Judgment Day, it was reasonable to think, well, this is Christ's return. And people fell to their knees in prayer. They ran to church. And as you say, I open with a true story of a father who ran home, believing that this was Judgment Day. He didn't want to stick around for what was coming, and he decided to take his young son with him, and he killed his son with an axe, and then he sliced his own throat with a razor. And this was really not that long ago, less than 150 years ago, that a total eclipse had that effect on people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to try to protect himself and his son from the wrath of the Lord, says, you know, the sun will be darkened in the final days.
Yeah, it seemed to come straight out of the Bible. Yeah. Exactly.
My goodness. Yeah. So for each of these scientists, as they make their way out there, and it's a harrowing journey, I want to talk about sort of what was accomplished there amongst each of them. Did Edison's device work? Was he able to make that happen?
Well, it's complicated. It's funny. If you read the newspaper coverage afterwards, it was self-contradictory. There'd be an article that would say his tachymeter succeeded, and then they would say that it failed. And it sort of succeeded and it sort of failed. So again, the tachymeter was a sensitive heat detector. And when he pointed it through his telescope at the solar corona, it did find heat. The problem was it found so much heat, he hadn't set his device correctly to actually get a meaningful reading. And as soon as he pointed at the corona, the needle just flew off the scale. So he detected heat, but what he wanted to do was measure it and say how much was there. and he couldn't do that. So it was kind of successful and it was kind of not successful. At the time, there was thought that the tizimeter, there were people saying the tizimeter was going to be more famous than the phonograph. obviously, that didn't happen. There were all sorts of ideas that, again, it was such a sensitive heat detector. Maybe you could put it in the hull of a ship and it could detect a distant iceberg because it could detect that the water temperature was changing ever so slightly, which really wouldn't have worked. But it became clear pretty soon after the eclipse that the tizimeter was a pretty clunky device. Yes, it could measure heat, but it really didn't, it did not give reproducible results. So as a scientific instrument, it really couldn't measure anything very well. And Edison, anyway, as soon as he got back from Wyoming, started work on a new invention, and that was the light bulb. And that became, of course, his obsession for the next few years and the most famous thing he's known for.
Yeah, and Watson, I think in the moment, it seemed like he thought he had found the elusive planet Vulcan. Right?
Well, James Craig Watson is, I would not have liked to have known him as a person, but he's a wonderful character. My goodness, he was pompous. He was very arrogant, and he was sure he would find Vulcan. And during the eclipse, he was sure he had found Vulcan. In fact, he thought he may have found two planets closer to the sun than Mercury, which that also fit with the idea, again, that there was reason to think that Mercury was not the closest planet to the sun, and it could be that there were multiple planets there. And after the eclipse, the big headline in 1878 was James Craig Watson has found Vulcan. And, you know, he was being hailed as the greatest astronomer of this time. And he had every reason to believe that it was true. But it didn't take long for his story to kind of fall apart. There were dozens and dozens of astronomers in the path of totality in 1878, many of them looking for Vulcan. No one else saw it. Well, there actually was one other person who thought he saw it, but his Vulcan didn't match up with where Watson saw his Vulcan. The whole thing started to fall apart, but Watson never gave up. And he was so certain that he really had found Vulcan and he needed to, you know, he were here was being publicly embarrassed. He wanted to reclaim his glory, that he had this ridiculous idea for building a telescope that he believed would find Vulcan in the daytime, not having to wait for another total eclipse. And he so exhausted himself in this effort to build that telescope, he died a few years after the eclipse.
Yeah. So just convinced that it was out there, didn't even allow for the opportunity that maybe it's just not there.
Yeah. So he really was sort of this operatic character.
What about Maria Mitchell? What did she achieve as it relates to the eclipse? You know, we have, you know, Watson looking for Vulcan. We have Edison trying to test his equipment. What was her, what'd she get out of the experience?
Well, scientifically, she was doing what the men were doing. She was looking for Vulcan. She didn't find it. So in that regard, she got it right and James Craig Watson got it wrong. She was studying the corona. I mean, people were just sketching it and trying to see what they could learn from it. But the most important thing about her expedition was not what she saw, but what other people saw when they looked at her and these women who had, again, on their own came out to Colorado for the eclipse. And, you know, there was a lot of coverage in the papers about just how remarkable this group of women was and how they, you know, they were really being held up as a role model for other women. And Maria Mitchell, you know, that one eclipse trip by itself didn't suddenly transform science and have men welcome women with open arms. But that was a very important event in her life, and her life was hugely influential in opening the doors of science to women. This was sort of toward the end of her career. She turned 60 when she was in Colorado, which I'm turning 60. I don't think that's all that old, but back then I think it was a bit older. And so this was kind of a capstone to her career and something that people really remembered.
Well, the book, once again, is American Eclipse. I'm with David Barron, the author of the book. I'm Logan Layden. You're listening to the KGOU Readers Club as we continue our conversation in advance of a total solar eclipse here in Oklahoma. very soon that people are going to be falling over themselves, now me included, after this conversation, to go and fully see, because it is such a different experience than the partial eclipses I think many people have seen. It's the KGOU Readers Club. I'm Logan Layden. More now with the author, David Barron, about the book, American Eclipse. We talk about the importance of this eclipse in 1878 for the country, the expeditions to go out and see it by these scientists. You don't, in the book, you know, credit this event with spurring America's scientific dominance or anything, but it did play some sort of role in that. If you could speak a little bit to what this did for America's reputation in the sciences and sort of the impact of it.
Well, so as I said earlier, I mean, Europe until this time really didn't think of the United States as much of a competitor when it came to science. And in fact, there were Europeans, Alexis de Tocqueville, who famously came to the United States in the early 19th century and wrote about American culture. He was speculating that the sciences would never be embraced by a democracy like this. It took a monarchy or a country at least run by the elites to care about science. Why would the normal rabble of the public want to invest in something so intellectual? And that's an interesting point, right? Well, why do we as a country care about science? When the general public sees the benefit of science or just is excited about science, that's what makes, we tell our elected leaders, we care about science. Well, here was a very public event. I mean, sort of like the moon landing in 1969, here was something all Americans were talking about. We saw it as our opportunity to show that we could compete with Europe. It sort of infused patriotism with science. And so in that regard, it just got the public jazzed up about science. And this was an era when kind of the infrastructure of science was being built, the scientific societies, the university departments of science, new prizes for scientists that were being established, the kinds of things you need if you're going to really, if you want to build a core of scientists who are going to go on and do great things. Those are being built at this time, and some of those are connected to the eclipse itself. James Craig Watson, who we already talked about, who thought he found the planet Vulcan and died a few years later, he, besides being quite an accomplished scientist, he also was a businessman and had raised a lot of money. And when he died, he left, unfortunately, he left some money to his wife, but he left a big chunk of his estate to the National Academy of Sciences to endow a prize in his own name. And so the James Craig Watson Medal was one of the first prizes that the National Academy of Sciences gave out to astronomers to help encourage science. And there are a number of little ways like that. Thomas Edison, who, again, in 1878, went west with the idea that he was not just an inventor, he was a scientist. He came back and he actually helped found the magazine, the journal called Science, which still exists today and is the premier journal of science in the United States. Thomas Edison started that because of what he learned during the eclipse. And having a really important science journal like that, again, is part of the infrastructure of science. So the 1878 eclipse by itself did not turn us into the global superpower in science by the 20th century, but it was one of those important stepping stones along the way.
Well, I want to talk a little bit here as we sort of get close to the end of our time about bringing this book together. There's so much detail in here, and how did you find all of this stuff? Take me through the process of putting this all together. What'd you do to make this happen?
It was a treasure hunt, which at first was exasperating and then became great fun. So as we talked about early on, I come from journalism. I worked in public radio. As a journalist, when you want to write a story, generally it means, you know, you call up the experts and you interview them and they tell you what you need to know and you put the story on the air or in the newspaper. But writing a book about things that happened 150 years ago, I couldn't call up Thomas Edison. I couldn't call up Mariah Mitchell. I had to go into the archives. I had to find their papers. I had to read their diaries and what they had published and the letters they wrote. So I spent a lot of time. I mean, some things have been digitized, but most have not. So I spent a lot of time at the National Archives and the Library of Congress in Washington, where a lot of the original documents from the 1878 eclipse have been are held. Vassar College, which of course has some of Mariah Mitchell's papers. There's also, she came from Nantucket, and the Mariah Mitchell Association there has her papers. I went to the University of Michigan for James Craig Watson's papers. Other papers are at Yale and Harvard and elsewhere. It was a lot of reading handwritten documents, but it was just great fun. I mean, the deeper I got into it, the more I loved these characters, and I just really wanted to know what they had to say to each other and about each other behind their backs. And I was reading old newspapers that, of course, you can do online for the most part because they've been digitized. That's a big help. But I just immersed myself in the world of the Gilded Age and the Wild West. And I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, the Gilded Age, which you talk about a little bit in the book there, not necessarily, so we call that period of time the Gilded Age, but it wasn't meant with that's not necessarily a positive.
No, it wasn't a compliment. Yeah. No, Mark Twain called it the Gilded Age, and he meant that there was just a veneer of shiny gold on the outside covering what was a worthless interior. And that is, you know, that's sort of what my book's about, is America was becoming rich, but what was it at its core? It didn't seem to have much of an intellectual core. And that's what was being developed around the time of the eclipse, was kind of a deeper meaning. Okay, we're becoming a powerful country. What do we want to do with all that power? What, you know, how are we going to contribute to civilization?
How long did it take you to do this book? When did you start it? You say it was originally published in 2017, right? So what we're getting now is kind of does it have a new foreword?
It has a new afterword.
New afterword.
So the new edition has like an essay at the end where I reflect on the 2017 eclipse and its importance in American history. But it took me about 5 years to write the book. And the first couple of years I was still had my day job while I was doing the original research. But then I spent about 2.5, 3 years doing nothing but the research and the writing to get it done. And this was a book with a deadline that could not be moved because it needed to come out before the total eclipse in August of 2017. And so I was, for those last 6 months, I had no life other than writing. But it was definitely a spur to get it done.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to this eclipse that we're, where are you now? Where do you live?
I live in Boulder, Colorado, and I will be in Waco, Texas for the eclipse.
So you are coming down for it.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it. And I actually had chosen Waco as a place to go several years ago, and my whole family's flying in for that. But we have a very fortunate other reason to be in Waco, which is something I never imagined when my book was first published in 2017. It's actually been turned into a musical. So a few years ago, some Broadway producers got in touch, and they thought there was a musical in this story. I thought it sounded a little crazy, but sure, let's see what happens. They ended up commissioning just a wonderful composer, lyricist named Michael John Lacusa to write the show. I saw a workshop production, a private production in New York about a year ago. It's just wonderful. It's still a work in progress, but it's just a terrific show. Anyway, it's going to see its world premiere performance in Waco at Baylor University on Sunday, April 7th. So the day before the total eclipse, there'll be two performances. There are a half dozen Broadway stars coming down to play the leading roles. They'll be backed up by an ensemble of performing arts students at Baylor. It'll be a concert performance, not a full show, but it should be great fun. So I am just thrilled by that. And one thing I hadn't expected, again, I had thought, you know, turning this into a musical I just didn't quite see it, but I do see it now. It works great. And particularly at the moment of the total eclipse, when Mariah Mitchell and James Craig Watson and Thomas Edison and a cast of 25 are looking into the heavens and singing in unison, I just have chills, because that brings to life the feeling I have at totality. It is this sense of harmony and oneness. You know, you just feel connected to the people around you, to the universe around you. And what better way to convey that than through song? So I'm thrilled that it's been turned into a musical.
Well, you've been chasing eclipses all over the world, as you say. Are you going to continue to do that going forward? I know this one is kind of coming into our backyard here, but this is something you're going to keep doing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, 2026, the Path of Totality goes over Greenland, Iceland, and Spain. I don't yet know where I'm going. 2027, over North Africa. 2028, over Australia. So I intend to see them all. And what I'm really looking forward to is the one in 2045, August 12th, 2045. That one will go from Northern California to Florida. It may cross Oklahoma. Actually, I bet it does. But what I know is it does cross Colorado, and doesn't go over my home, but it goes over Colorado Springs and over Pikes Peak. And if there was anywhere I wish I had been in 1878 to see that eclipse, it would have been on top of Pikes Peak, because the people who were up there at 14,000 feet reported seeing the moon's shadow as this palpable curtain of doom racing toward them at 2,000 miles an hour, swallowing everything in front of it. They could see the distant peaks in sunlight suddenly pop out of existence as the moon's shadow moved in, and it just washed over them. So August 12th, 2045, I will be on top of Pikes Peak.
And is that going to be the next sort of nearby opportunity for a total eclipse here in North
America?
Yeah,
if you miss this one, there's one in 2044 that just barely touches the U.S. It'll be in Montana and North Dakota. But then August 12th, 2045, that's the next big one. So again, if you don't get yourself into the path of the total eclipse this year, you're going to have to wait another 20 years for as good an opportunity.
You talked about seeing it from Pikes Peak, or hoping to. That is one question I wanted to ask you. As you've been around looking at these eclipses in different places, are each of them unique, or do you see the same thing every time? Are they each different experience?
Yeah. They're all different. Yeah, of course, they're all variations on a theme, but the solar corona is different. So again, the main thing you'll be gawking at if you have clear skies is the beautiful wreath-like atmosphere of the sun. The shape of the corona is always different. Sometimes it's symmetrical like a sunflower. Sometimes it has big streamers coming off on either sides. Sometimes you see what look like giant red flames coming off the sun called prominences. Sometimes you don't see them. Sometimes you see a bunch of planets. Sometimes you see very few. This year, we're likely to see at least four planets with the sun. That'll be quite something. Sometimes the sky gets quite dark. Sometimes it doesn't get all that dark, depending on how wide the shadow is, depending on where you are in the path of the shadow, depending on the angle that the moon's shadow is meeting the earth. So there are all these variables. Also, it makes a difference whether you're by yourself or, you know, in a remote area versus in a big city. And I've experienced both. And they're both wonderful. In 1999, I was in Munich, Germany, on the roof of a high-rise hotel in the middle of the city. And that was a great place to see a total eclipse, because I could see on rooftops all around me and in the streets below hundreds of thousands of people gathered. And as the moon's shadow raced in over the city, there was this collective cheer, all these voices together as we saw the solar corona come out. So, I mean, there are just so many different ways to enjoy a total eclipse.
Well, yeah, I mean, you would, looks like, I've got the map here. If you're in Dallas, you're going to, all those millions of people down there are going to be able to be in the totality by not going anywhere.
Absolutely. Same in Little Rock. Mm-hmm. Same in Indianapolis. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite of the ones you've seen?
Well,
other than
I
the
would
first
say
one.
The first one, because it was the first, because until you see it, you just don't know how you're going to react. In 2019, I was on a beach in Chile, and the solar corona was just beautiful. I mean, it looked like a, it had these like so, sort of like a flower with these two beautiful petals coming out on opposite sides. So that really stands out. Last year, I went to Australia to see a total eclipse that lasted 56 seconds. That's the briefest I've ever seen. but it was beautiful too.
Well, again, the book is American Eclipse. The author is David Baron. I'm Logan Layden. This is the KGOU Readers Club. If people are interested in reading the book, any advice on where to find it, how to get
It's
it?
available everywhere. I mean, and it's available also as an ebook and an audiobook. I might point folks to my website, which is American-Eclipse.com, in case anyone has a book group. I have a downloadable book club kit, which has some suggested discussion questions and a Q&A with me, that sort of thing, that might be useful as well.
Well, I hope that over the course of the last hour, I've hit some of those points that are in the guide to how to do this as a Reader's Club book. Really entertaining read. This is not a research paper. This is a story. You're a storyteller, and it was a real pleasure to learn about not only people like Thomas Edison, who I knew some about, but not obviously this aspect of his life, but then other people like Mariah Mitchell. Who I was introduced to because of the book that you wrote and her important contributions. And thank you for your time as well, Mr. Barron.
Well, thank you, Logan. I appreciate what you said. I mean, my goal in writing the book was just to tell a good human tale. Yes, it's got science in it, but I don't want people who don't think of themselves as interested in science to stay away. The whole point is it's a total eclipse is a human experience first. You don't have to know anything about astronomy to appreciate it.
What's happening here in Oklahoma on April 8th. And if David Baron is any indicator, you'd be wise to get yourself into the path of totality so that you can experience it as well. Thank you, Mr. Baron. Thank you for writing this book. This is the KGOU Readers Club, and we thank you, listeners, for joining us today.